This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Today we are joined by former Mr. Indy Leclerc, now Dr. Indy Leclerc of JVCA. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Thank you. It's weird to be on the other side of the table in our tiny recording studio.
And it's been a while since you've been on, right?
It has been a while, yeah, because I left Manchester to finish writing my thesis up, and I've just come back to do my Viva, and obviously the most important part was recording a JodBite for the JodCast. So
congratulations on the Viva.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your first JodBite interview.
Well, yeah, first on this. I'm not going to do another one for a while.
Who knows? So could you first tell us, I guess, what was the title of your thesis?
The title was The Local Radio Sky: High-frequency resolution, single-dish studies of polarized galactic synchrotron emission around 1.4 gigahertz. Not the snappiest title.
Catchy.
but I think I was told descriptive is good, so descriptive it is.
And yeah. Was the first thing you were asked in your Viva, what did you do?
I mean, the Viva was just, it was quite long. It was like 3.5 hours, and they just asked me a bunch of questions on my thesis, pretty much going from page one to page... Don't want to relive it.
That sounds like no fun. I remember talking to you before it, and you were like, you know, I don't know what to expect, and it's the unknown is frightening, and I was saying, you know, I like to imagine, and I comfort myself with the thought that, like, you go in there and it probably doesn't feel like it's taking 3.5 hours. Did it feel like 3.5 hours?
Not at all. The first 2 hours went by, and one of the examiners was like, oh, that's been 2 hours already. And I was like, are you kidding me? That felt like 10 minutes.
So nice.
That much fun.
I don't know if I call it fun, but it definitely went by really, really quickly. Once you're in it, they do make you feel at ease. And at the end of the day, you're talking about something that you've been working on for the last 4 years. So, yeah, I like to think I know what I was talking about, at least yesterday.
Well, they think you know what you were talking about.
Clearly they did, yeah.
You have the title to prove it.
I do.
Tell us about the radio sky. Why is it special at 0.4 gigahertz?
1.4 gigahertz.
Why is it special at 1.4 gigahertz?
Yeah, the main theme of what I've been doing for my PhD was studying what's known as diffuse radio emission in the Milky Way. So that's stuff that basically isn't a point source. So radio emission that doesn't come from pulsars or doesn't come from objects, but is just kind of cloudy, fairly neglected side of what's going on in the sky. But it's really cool because when you point a radio telescope up at the right sort of frequencies, and if you've got the right kind of telescope as well, because the easiest way to study this diffuse emission is using single dish telescopes as opposed to interferometers, because interferometers have great resolution. But it's like the thing where the analogy of looking at an elephant with a magnifying glass, you probably at some point have no idea that you're actually looking at an elephant. Whereas if you look with a single dish telescope, you can see much more extended and broad features. And so you start to see this really great, it's almost cloud-like patterns in the sky. And so I was doing, most of my observations came from the Arecibo telescope, which our listeners may or may not be familiar with, but it's the big 300-meter dish that's in Puerto Rico in the Caribbean.
It's the James Bond telescope.
It is the GoldenEye telescope. It was in Contact as well. And I've been there, but we got to walk up on the gantry on the top and above it, which is actually terrifying because there's a tiny wiry suspension bridge that leads to like the middle of this dish, and you're I don't know, it's like 100 meters up in the air above this slightly swaying and etc.
Yeah, because you're basically standing over this big crater, right?
It's where, you know, James Bond pushed Sean Bean to his death, so
poor Sean Bean, that man can't catch a break.
clearly so that was an amazing experience, and I got to actually do remote observation with Arecibo from my bedroom, which is pretty cool because you push a button on your computer and a huge chunk of metal halfway across the world starts moving. Pretty cool as well. And we get these really cool pictures. I know that it's a bit of a cliche to say that all we do in astronomy is make pretty pictures, but in my case, it was kind of true. So listeners, check out the cover art for the episode. So as I was saying, so I'm studying the diffuse emission, and so this emission is caused by electrons that sort of float around in space, which have generated by very energetic events in the galaxy, like shock fronts or also pulsar winds. These electrons are actually moving at relativistic speed, so appreciable fractions of the speed of light. And So when these electrons encounter magnetic fields, they get accelerated and they sort of start having this spiral motion. If you've got a magnetic field going in sort of one direction, the electron itself will kind of spiral around the field direction. And when you get a spiraling electron, that what that does is that emits energy in the form of light. And in this case, because of the geometry of the situation, it will emit radio frequency light. And so this is what we pick up with our telescopes, and it generates this really cool structure. So clearly the emission is really linked to the magnetic fields that you can find in the Milky Way or in the interstellar medium, which is, you know, the stuff between the stars. And I mean, people say space is empty, but it really isn't to astronomers. And so the ISM is not very dense at all, but you can still see all sorts of stuff in between stars and things. And so I was basically looking at that, this diffuse emission. So the first reason we study them is to actually look at the ISM and magnetic fields, which in our Milky Way we don't have a clear picture of. We know some things about the magnetic field in the Milky Way, partially based on our own observations, partially based on observations of other galaxies. And the interesting thing is that in spiral galaxies, you've got a magnetic field that actually follows the shape of the spiral. So you've got this large-scale magnetic field, which is quite weak, but it's still there. It has this big, large structure. And then at smaller scales, you have more turbulent, sort of messy magnetic fields that that generate more diffuse emission.
So are these magnetic fields sort of compounded from all the things within the galaxy, or are they dominated by maybe the supermassive black hole at the center?
So it's unclear how the large-scale magnetic field actually arises, but the best theory is that you start off with some small seed field from a supernova or some other primordial origin from when the galaxy itself was very young, and then this field sort of gets amplified because you wind it up essentially, and you increase the strength using a sort of dynamo mechanism.
Basically. That's really interesting. So presumably you were looking at the polarization.
So that's the other aspect of things that you look at, is that this synchrotron radiation, this diffuse radio emission, is actually highly polarized. So the light is emitted in a preferred sort of direction, and that actually tells you straight away what the magnetic field orientation is that generated the emission. And it's actually the interesting thing about polarized radiation or polarized light is that when it passes through a plasma, the angle of polarization actually rotates depending on the wavelength. And this effect is called Faraday rotation. And you can use it to determine a lot of cool things because it depends on stuff like electron density, the field strength itself. And so one big part of my thesis was applying Faraday rotation analysis to the polarized emission from the Milky Way and finding out more about either interesting objects or like supernova remnants or bubbles of ionized hydrogen, or just generally the magnetic field itself, which you can determine using Faraday rotation.
That's really cool, because I've heard of similar techniques being used to study AGN magnetic fields, which mm-hmm. have a similar sort of thing where they get kind of wound up by the mm-hmm. rotating black hole. And I didn't know that that was also being applied to our own Milky Way and things in the Milky Way. It is.
I mean, the idea is that, you know, our Milky Way is, there's nothing special about it. It's a spiral galaxy amongst many other spiral galaxies. So it should have the same or similar properties to spiral galaxies that we can see from the outside. And we've measured the magnetic field in a couple of the spiral arms, but we don't have like a full picture at all. And so a lot more work needs to be done to have a full observational picture, but also accurate computer models of the magnetic field.
So how far out do the magnetic fields extend from the Milky Way? Because, I mean, magnetic fields just sort of get weaker and weaker forever, right?
Well, the thing is, the way we measure them means that we can only see them indirectly through radiation or through other effects that they might have. So as soon as you move away from the Milky Way, I'm not really sure, because it's very difficult to measure distance along the line of sight, especially when you're dealing with looking through the Milky Way when there's a lot of stuff there, and it's kind of difficult to see when it ends. But from what we've seen in other spiral galaxies, it seems to stay around the galaxy pretty well, as it does. I don't think it extends very far out from the galaxy itself.
So you've been building maps?
Yeah, I've been making maps and then using the maps and analyzing the map to get answers and to get like information about the structure of the diffuse emission. You can put a number on it. You can use mathematical techniques to actually quantify the shape of things that appear in the maps. And the last thing that I was doing with these foreground maps is, again, in relation to this diffuse radio emission, it's that it basically constitutes a foreground when you're actually looking at the CMB, at the cosmic microwave background. So, I mean, CMB comes up all the time on the Jodcast, but it is, as its name suggests, a background. So in order to look at it properly, you need to get everything else out of the way, which includes our own galaxy, because obviously we're observing from within it, and then other stuff, extragalactic things and etc. But even though we study the CMB at higher frequencies than the few gigahertz frequencies that I'm looking at the diffuse radio emission with, synchrotron emission actually is present all the way up to several tens of gigahertz. And so it's very useful to understand the behavior of the emission, like what it looks like and how it varies with frequency and what the effects of things like Faraday rotation are and how it varies in the sky. So, you know, are there empty patches that we can select to actually do more precise measurements of the CMB? So the other aspect of my work was actually doing this and characterizing the synchrotron foregrounds so that we can put limits on how much it contaminates CMB measurements.
So you'd be adding error bars effectively to models like Planck?
You're not exactly adding error bars, but you're helping them subtract the stuff that's in the way. You're saying, I can tell you exactly what you need to subtract in order to get the CMB. And you can also say, you can look in this patch of sky because the contamination is low enough that you can kind of ignore it, for example. So, yeah.
So, yeah, basically it'll be a corrective.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So, when I was doing my master's for a similar reason, like we were measuring Faraday rotation, and but you'd have to refer back to these papers. I think we had a Pushkarev et al., who just a big table of all the different corrections you had to make to the different patches of sky.
Yeah.
Due to like foreground.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It's
you'll be
pretty
contributing
much
to that.
Yeah. It's something like that. And the reason it's really important is because I've been also looking at the polarization, and with the CMB, the next frontier is obviously is detecting polarized CMB and these famous B modes that would be an indicator of inflation having occurred in the early universe. These things are incredibly faint and incredibly difficult to detect, and so my work is characterizing specifically the polarized foregrounds to be able to better remove them so that we can finally try and find these B modes.
So it's, I guess the first thing you'd recommend is look off the galactic plane.
Yeah, exactly. What you're looking at are high latitudes, high galactic latitudes, so away from the plane. Essentially just take the plane and look up or below it. But what I ended up finding is that you can use more of the sky than we thought we could. So there are the sky is actually emptier of synchrotron radiation than, well, no one had really properly quantified it. And I've sort of said, well, okay, actually, it turns out that people have just been using small patches to make sure that they were really empty, but it turns out you can use much wider areas of sky at high latitudes, and that's actually really useful because that means that you can get, well, more sky coverage means more information, and so you can combine several bits of sky to gain sensitivity and basically make a better measurement.
And have you found that it's homogeneous across patches of sky?
No, not really, actually. That's what's really interesting is that, like, it does vary a lot, and if you get local features, so things that happen that are much closer to us than to the rest of the Milky Way, then that just throws everything off and, you know, it changes it completely. So it's quite, the sky is quite interesting. But you
can, all agree on that. Yeah.
But you can figure out which bits are empty and which bits are not so empty.
Awesome.
Cool.
Thanks very much, Indy.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you,
anytime. It's been a pleasure to be on the other side of the table, and, I may come back at some point.
We hope you do.
Yeah, please do.
Come back for another presenting at some point.
Yeah, that would be fun. Right. Cheers.